morning, everyone, and welcome to Thursday Morning Roundtable. My name is Emily Winke, and I'm the Community Engagement Coordinator here at Syracuse University. I would like to begin, as we do with all Syracuse University events, by acknowledging with respect the Onondaga Nation, firekeepers of the Haudenosaunee, the indigenous people on whose ancestral lands Syracuse University now stands. Before I introduce this morning's speakers, I want to thank everyone for being flexible and patient with us as we transition TMR to a virtual platform. This morning's panel from WCNY's Ivory Tower will be moderated by Dave Shenatry, Professor of Journalism at Utica College and Director of the New York Reporting Project. He is joined by Christy Anderson, Luke Perry, Bob Spitzer, and Nina Moore. Christy Anderson is Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Syracuse University, where she was a member of the Maxwell School faculty from 1984 to 2016. Luke Perry is Chair and Professor of Government at Utica College and Director of the Utica College Center of Public Affairs and Election Research. Bob Spitzer is Distinguished Service Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at the State University College of New York College at Portland. Nina Moore is Professor and Chair of the Political Science Department at Colgate University in Hamilton, New York. Please join me in welcoming Ivory Tower.
Thank you, everybody, and thanks for inviting us to Thursday Morning Roundtable. I'm Dave Shenatry, and as Emily just said, I'm the host of Ivory Tower. I began my term about the same time Donald Trump began his, and right now we are all waiting to see whether I will outlast him. So I am just like all of you, up late, way too late at night, cycling through countless websites, watching Steve Kornacki and John King go through the big boards and slice and dice the electorate. I think actually we should go back to a simpler way because I can't follow that. They speak too fast for me now. So I don't offer any particular election analysis because we have such a panel of experts to do that. So Emily told us who we have on today. Our regular panel, of course, includes several other people as well that we cycle through the program. And if you watch, we're really happy to do. So what I would like to do, Emily's going to send me your questions and I'll direct them to our panelists. But right now, we'd just like to turn it over to the IT folks not in a way that means we have problems with our computer, but I'll throw it to Luke to give us his analysis. I missed what he had to say in one analysis he did yesterday with the Center for Public Affairs. So this should be interesting for me too. So Luke.
Thank you, Dave. Good morning, everybody. So I think one narrative coming out of the election as results continue to unfold here is how close it is. And I think we're going to see a narrow victory for Joe Biden and perhaps somewhere around 270, the minimum, 290, maybe clears 300. Depends on how he does in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Georgia that continue to get counted. And then, of course, that is contingent on him holding Arizona and Nevada, where he's currently leading. So these final five states are particularly interesting and continue to take some time to tabulate. One thing that I'm intrigued on is that I think this is, in terms of the presidency, a good night for Democrats. I think a lot of Democrats hoped that Biden would pick up a Florida and, it would be a strong repudiation of Donald Trump. It's not going to be that. It's going to be a narrow victory, most likely. But I don't think we should overlook the fact that it's 1992 was the last time that an incumbent president lost. So it is significant. And as this process unfolds, I look at it in three steps. Step one is to finalize the vote counting. Step two is the legal process that's going to unfold as the Trump campaign challenges certain ballots. And then step three is the transition. And kind of looking around the bend, Donald Trump hasn't followed a lot of norms when it comes to the presidency. And I wouldn't expect him to follow the norm that we have seen from both parties in regards to the transition. So I think that's going to be an interesting situation. Now, on the other hand, I think Republicans did very well in Congress. Looks like they're going to hold the Senate, even though they had a very difficult map and had to defend 2/3 of the seats. And it looks like they quite possibly are going to gain seats in the House. And throughout our region and throughout the state of New York, including our region, it was a good night for Republicans. In 2018, the Democrats gained 3 seats in the House. And it looks, per the tallies now, that they're going to lose 2 out of those 3 seats. Representative Brindisi in NY22 has a very difficult task in making up a 30,000 ballot gap as the absentees are counted. And then downstate, it looks like Max Rose is going to lose as well. So that leaves only Antonio Delgado in NY19 surviving this trio of incumbent Democratic freshmen elected during Trump's first midterm. So I'll stop there and pass it along to my colleagues.
Christy, what would you like to offer us?
Well, a couple of things. One is about this the post-election day vote challenging. And Trump, of course, is claiming that still that votes cast in in different ways, absentee votes or early votes, may be illegitimate, and there are now 300 Republican lawsuits which are challenging the vote in various ways. I thought it was interesting, though, that in the past couple of days, a number of Republican elected officials pushed back at that. Even Mitch McConnell said something like, declaring victory is not the same as having the votes, or Chris Christie said also basically things, and Mike DeWine, the governor of Ohio, and a few other people too, basically said things like, you have to let the votes be counted, all votes should be counted, and so on. And that's a good sign, because that particular norm violation of Trump is, I think, particularly disturbing to me, the idea that certain people's votes are illegitimate, or votes cast in certain ways that have been set up by boards of election are illegitimate. So that's one point I would make. Second point, and this is just a kind of odd little quirky one. I gave a talk about the Electoral College yesterday, and I assume this election, like others, will bring up people's objections to the Electoral College or worries about it and so on. Hmm. And I want to point out that one way we could keep the Electoral College, but make its results more proportional to the public preferences, is to do what Maine and Nebraska have done, which is to allocate their electoral votes somewhat proportionally. And my home state of Nebraska has given 1 electoral vote of its 5 to Joe Biden. They have 1 Democratic congressional district, and I think that's worth talking about a little bit. I don't have much to hypothesize about this, but I would be interested in what my colleagues think about the fact that the polls seemed to be in many cases not very accurate. And polls are not predictions, but the polls were off, and I saw a lot of editorials in the papers this morning about that. I think, and Luke alluded to this maybe, that the Trump strength was surprising, both his own strength and the fact that he seemed to pull people like Claudia Tenney along with him. Tenney ran a very Trumpish campaign and did much better than I would have expected. So those are some nuggets.
Okay, a friend of mine texted me yesterday, and he said, polling is the new astrology. Bob Spitzer?
Yes, good morning. I guess the first point I'd make, sort of picking up on what Christy was saying, is that this is very much a nationalized election, and there couldn't be a clearer example than the Brindisi-Tenney race, where Claudia Tenney's virtually entire campaign was the charge that the claim that Brindisi was against Trump, and of course he's a Democrat, Trump's a Republican, and that was really all she needed as a primary message. Now the results aren't fully in, the write-ins haven't been counted yet, and write-in votes have leaned Democratic, so the local race between Tenney and Brindisi might tighten up, but it looks like Tenney will take that. but the nationalization of politics continues in the sense that the Trump-Biden face-off very much had a profound effect on local races all around the country. Secondly, the Democrats pretty clearly underperformed compared to the polls. And this is also something Christy was mentioning. And I think I would want to see the final tabulated results to then compare to poll numbers to see to what degree the polls were off, because the polls and pollsters took a real beating from 2016, which to some extent was not deserved, because right. The national polls were basically right. Some of the state polls were off, but again, it was those races were so close that the margin of error, that the predictions were within margin of error, which statistically doesn't mean they were off per se. But they did seem to be off more this time. And the clearest example I can think of was the Susan Collins race, where the polls seemed to show her pretty far behind. I haven't checked them recently, by more than a margin of error. And she wound up apparently winning fairly comfortably. I haven't seen the final numbers there. So, I mean, Maine is kind of a difficult state perhaps to poll just because of its geography and makeup. But still, there will be lots of soul searching about polls. And it does look as though Biden will get the electoral votes he needs from Michigan, Wisconsin, Nevada, Arizona. And the Democrats seem to be more confident that they have a real shot at Georgia or North Carolina. And of course, Pennsylvania, I'm not so sure about all three of those, but Biden may ultimately prevail on one of those. I will mention also the dog that did not bark on Tuesday. That is to say, there was no violence. There was no mayhem. All across the country, people voted like normal. Local election officials did their job diligently. And there's a huge aid to give out to election officials all across the country, including here in Central New York, who did a terrific job, really. There were some very minor glitches, but where was all the violence? One poll showed that over 70% of Americans were fearful of election day violence, and there was nothing, as far as I heard. Certainly nobody bringing guns to polling places, thank heavens. Now, maybe in the weeks to come, depending on how things unfold, there may be demonstrations or you know, who knows, but things went very, very well in terms of the conduct and administration of this election. I will just leave it at that, and let's have questions and pass it over to Nina.
Right, we have to hear from Nina, and we do have a question which we'll get to right after this about Arizona, because Arizona, Bob, you put that in Biden's camp, but it's still pretty tight. So we'll leave that hanging for a moment and turn to Nina.
Okay. First, thank you for this forum. I said to David in an email that I sent to him this morning, I said, you know, I don't know if this is going to be better for me or for the TMR audience, because it's going to be somewhat cathartic for me to get some things off of my chest. But I'll begin by agreeing with my co-panelists, who I think have brilliantly pinpointed some of the trends and issues that have emerged so far. But I do want to also follow both Christy and Bob's lead in thinking about what is ahead, right? So what is ahead with respect to rethinking our polls, and what's ahead with respect to thinking about the Electoral College? But in my case, I'd like to think more about our politics broadly writ, because my thought, in fact, my very strong sense is that we will in 2024 again see either Donald Trump or his evil twin, or in this case, I'll just say his twin, right? Because we have, in my view, sufficient evil already there. And the reason that I say that is because what this election has shown us is that there's fertile terrain for the kind of politics that Trump has engaged the country in. Consider these facts to sort of support that. Just basically 68 million Americans have voted for him, but more than that, hundreds of thousands literally risked their lives in order to attend his rallies. More people interpret the lens of reality through the frameworks that Trump provides for him, whether it is COVID and the fact that it's a serious problem, that masks need to be worn, or if it's simply Russia and whether there really was Russia interference, despite the fact that the intelligence community has established that, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt. So again, My first point here, in sum and substance, is that there is good reason to think about a Trump comeback in 2024 in the event that he does lose, or something very much like Trump. And so that sort of leads me to my second point, which is that Democrats face a real challenge, and the challenge goes well beyond the kinds of, you know, difficulties that we've witnessed emerge over the past few days. The challenge for Democrats is to figure out why it is that so many working class Americans are still nonetheless inclined to pin their hopes on a candidate, on a person who has failed to deliver on so many of his policies, his boldest promises, such as to build what he termed as a beautiful wall. He's only constructed 300 plus miles to pass a middle class tax. That's what he promised in sort of the lead up to the 2018 election. He promised to replace Obamacare, and it is painfully, undeniably clear that he doesn't even have a plan. He's failed to address other things: Russia's interference in American elections, the bounties on the head of American soldiers. He's the first president ever potentially to leave office with fewer jobs and actually a record-setting job loss during his term. And then finally, he has arguably harmed the economy that he inherited and that he bragged so much about by turning a blind eye to COVID and engaging in happy talk and wanting to purportedly spare Americans from the awful news of it, while at the same time not preparing a plan. So again, on the second point, in sum and substance, the challenge is for Democrats to figure out why those who had voted for President Obama switched to vote for Trump and apparently are sticking with him. I'd like to make just one third quick point, and that is, I don't believe the answer is that they believe he's going to do something with the economy. They believe that he's committed to their interests. I think that we, contrary also to what Biden has said, we are not in a fight for the soul of America. We are smack dab in the middle of a fight for defining what is the quote unquote American way. What does America represent? And does America represent the kind of country that includes transgender bathroom rights, which I think is a very key cultural issue? Does it include real police accountability and not just talk about it? Does it include extending the right, the universal right to healthcare? Does it include an obligation to protecting the environment, and not just an obligation, but prioritizing that in a way that means shifting away from other more problematic sources of energy? Does it include more or less immigration? And does the quote unquote American way include America remaining as a leader on the world stage? So again, in sum and substance, I don't think this is about, you know, a fight for the soul of America or making America great again. It is about defining what is the American way and the extent to which that conception of the American way includes the things that are now on the table for discussion.
Okay, thank you, Nina. Now, we did mention Arizona, and we have a question about that. So let me toss it out. I guess, Luke, maybe I'll turn to you on this. And the question is, we keep hearing different messages about who actually won in Arizona. And why is that?
Well, we are dealing with unofficial results now, and you have news organizations and research organizations that analyze the votes that are in and the votes that are still remaining to be counted, and whether those are coming from registered Democrats, whether they're coming from registered Republicans, and what the trends are in a given state like Arizona as the, particularly the absentee ballots get counted. So it's where those are coming from and who seems to benefit from that process. And so what you have in Arizona is you have different media organizations making determinations about whether to call the state or not. So Fox News called it. Trump campaign was very upset because I believe they were the first to do so. And you've had other organizations file suit, but not all major media organizations. So you look at the New York Times, the Washington Post, it's still open. So the way I view that is it's Biden's on track to win it, but I think there's a divide over whether we have sufficient information to unofficially put it in his category at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. It does seem like there's almost this groundswell saying that Biden's won, but Biden could still very well lose and Trump could still pull this out. It seems to me. We have a question about Trump's support among Blacks. While it's still not a lot of support, he did improve from last time. And why might that be? Anybody want to, Bob? Were you about to?
Go ahead, Bob.
Well, it's clear that Trump has an appeal to some segments of the small segments of the African-American community. I wouldn't make too much of it because when you're talking about over 90% support for the Democrats among African-Americans and you're parsing the remaining 10%, give or take, a small change in that number, you know, as the questioner says, increase from 4 to 8%, it's a fairly small number. I'm not sure I would attach tremendous significance to it. I think the more interesting question is about Latino votes, Latinx votes throughout the country, which went for Trump in a bigger way, although a majority still voting for Biden. But Nina, why don't you?
I'll just dovetail directly on your thoughts, Bob, about the Latino vote and say that Florida, which apparently is going to Trump, as many of us have heard, sort of underscores the reality that it is pretty much impossible to consider the Latino vote as being monolithic. Certainly in Florida, you have the Cuban population that's much larger and that has traditionally voted Republican and much more conservative on a number of other issues, not the least of which socialism, Cuba. And then there's also the issue of Venezuela. With respect to Black votes, I think the question is certainly, as Bob pointed it out, why, the fact that there isn't a real problem when you look at the actual vote pattern, that you still have the overwhelming percent of Black voters supporting Biden. I think the issue here, and we'll be able to learn more about the data later, is the extent to which the Biden-Harris ticket succeeded in motivating a sufficient number of Blacks to go to the polls. Because what we saw in 2016 is there was a dip in the number of Blacks who did participate. And so that's what I think is the issue.
Mm-hmm. The president all through the campaign talked a lot about the historically low unemployment rate among Blacks. He's done more than anyone since Abraham Lincoln, and maybe even including him, right? But what about that aspect of it? Just a pure economic thing. Things are doing better. I mean,
I can say something about that. I think Nina put her finger on much of an explanation for a lot of this, which is this creation of a Trumpist alternative reality through Fox News and social media and so on. And one of the aspects of that alternative reality is that the economy's fine, and it will just snap back as soon as this is over, and the pandemic is just the end of it is just around the corner. I mean, Trump emphasizes the growth in jobs, from the second quarter to the third quarter and so on. Well, yeah, but that was from a historic low. So looked at in another way, it's not really a good economic thing. But I've also heard people interviews saying that the economy was really terrific, really wonderful before the pandemic. I heard somebody, a Latino person in Nevada, being interviewed this morning, he said that, and then he said, and really Trump has handled the pandemic just as well as he could have, and as soon as that's over, the economy will be back in good shape. Well, I think those of us who read the mainstream media, so to speak, or listen to it are less convinced of all those things. But people who have basically, and this is a bigger issue because it has to do with decline of local media, trusted local media. It has to do with, the rise of Fox News and the rise of conspiracy websites and so forth. But I look forward to communication scholars / political scientists doing a better job that I would like to see of talking about the connection between people's vote preferences and their media diets. And I think that's an important research path to follow.
That's when, if I could go back, and I agree with everything that Christy has said so far, but if I could go back to Dave's question about claim about Trump sort of, you know, reimagining himself as greater than Abraham Lincoln and doing more for Blacks than every other president in the history of the country, there are a couple of things to consider there, right? So on the one hand is the fact that Black unemployment is lower than it has ever been, but that is not the issue when it comes to race. The issue when it comes to race is, where does Black unemployment rest relative to white unemployment? And it's the gap in between that concerns racial equality or the lack thereof. The second point I would make is, if on the one hand, Trump is certainly moving forward Black economic prosperity with his last minute plan, right? He's got so many last minute plans to help Blacks and Latinos, like he's suddenly discovered, oh, there's something I can do here. But setting that aside, the real issue is, if you offer racial economic progress on the one hand, and on the other hand, you promote racial violence and bigotry, and you promote white supremacy, then that's not even a net gain. That's five steps backward.
Yes.
Thank you. We have a question about polling and a suggestion from someone in the audience that perhaps some people, older people, may not have wanted to answer polls simply because they weren't sure of who the pollster was and were afraid in this environment that perhaps they would be somehow targeted if they gave the wrong answer. And so that, I think that leads into a discussion of polling. I mean, what went wrong? Bob, you were suggesting maybe it didn't completely go wrong, but certainly in some places it seemed to.
Well, yeah. I mean, I agree. My earlier point about the Susan Collins race in Maine and how pollsters got that wrong. We do need to take a longer look at the polls, but there's several things going on. And Luke, I'm sure, can speak to this as well. First of all, remember, polling is done these days by telephone. Fewer people have landlines than ever. I think more than 40% of Americans have dispensed with their landlines and have only cell phones. People are increasingly likely to screen their phone calls. And there's generally greater suspicion about polling and pollsters. And now which leads to the related question, do people just systematically lie to the pollsters? That's probably not the main dynamic. There may be some people who do that. That at least is one thing that pollsters have studied, anticipated, and the wayward results that we get probably are not because people systematically are lying, but there is more suspicion. And also the alternative of internet polling is still problematic. It's too difficult to get a random sample. Right. And remember too, that pollsters above all want to get it right, because their reputation stands or falls on their ability to to correctly have their pulse on the American public, have their fingers on the American public pulse, aside from pollsters who are partisan pollsters and work for the campaigns.
You know, if pollsters are getting this wrong, yeah, Luke, I'll go right to you. If pollsters are getting this wrong, what else are they getting wrong, right? We poll about everything, whether this policy is favorable or, you know, who wants to have a public option or Medicare for all or anything. I mean, Luke?
In the camp of let's take a breath and slow down in terms of polling, the polling was not wrong in 2016. The national polling was right, and 48 out of 50 state polls were right. Wisconsin and Michigan were wrong, and they were pivotal states, and it turned the election. So I get the angst about that. We look at this cycle. I think we should wait till the data comes in, but even if, and we have the final tallies, but even if we want to start looking at this, we have to remember that polls have a stated margin of error of 3 to 6 points, which means it can swing in either direction. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people look at a poll and says, Biden's up two. Then if it's not Biden up two, the poll's wrong. I have more latitude. I take the margin of error at face value as the pollsters provided. And looking at the average polling coming down the stretch, it had Georgia as a toss-up. It's a toss-up. It had North Carolina as a toss-up. It's a toss-up. Arizona, Biden was up two. He's about up two right now. It had Biden up two in Florida, so that was wrong, but still probably within the margin of error. It had Biden winning Minnesota by 9. He's going to win and probably be within the margin of error of that poll. There are glaring examples of where it doesn't seem to be right. Wisconsin up 9. It's probably not going to work out that way. And Ohio, a toss-up. So I don't want to ignore the fact there are probably some states where it didn't work out. But even my initial assessment says, well, even though this is closer than some people thought, you break down the average polling coming down the stretch, it's not far off. And the last point I'll make very briefly is that this is a very different electoral process. So I'm also sympathetic to pollsters because 85% of Americans could vote by mail for the first time. And that makes it very difficult to anticipate what percent of the electorate is going to be Democrat and what percent is going to be Republican. So even if these polls are off in some places slightly, I do think we have to have a little bit of patience and understanding that this is the first time Americans have voted by mail in this way, which does make it more difficult for pollsters to do their job.
And that raises another question. If so many people voted by mail, as you say, do we have any sense for how much of that vote has been tossed because of improperly filled out ballots?
I think the answer is no. It would be, there's no national accounting for that. Those numbers will be released or will be available from state or even local county boards of elections eventually, but no, I think. I wanted to agree with Luke in various ways that A, the polls were right pretty much in 2016, and they may well be pretty correct now. I do, however, think it is, as he alluded to, more and more difficult to poll now. Maybe from skepticism, but also because people, as Bob said, don't have landlines and are more reluctant to answer and so on. But there are a couple important points that Luke said that I want to reiterate about polling. One is there is a margin of error, and that's on a good poll stated. So you need to give them the 4 or 5 point leeway there. And the other thing is that the polls are snapshots in time. They are not necessarily predictions of voting. And I think that's something that people need to hear over and over and over again. I do have, though, I think there's, and I'd be interested in what Luke said about this, people like Nate Silver, 538, and other folks who are pollsters and who do, I think, an interesting job of aggregating the polls and comparing them and so on, have also started in the last couple of election cycles, I think, using those to make forecasts. You remember the famous, Hillary Clinton has a whatever chance of winning and Donald Trump only has a much lower chance of winning. They are using the polls not just as a snapshot in time of how the electorate is feeling then, but forecasting the winners. And I think that has damaged or made problematic people's view of, they're looking, it encourages people to look at the polls as voting forecasts.
Yeah, if I could jump in here and I agree that there, as Christy has pointed out, there has to be attention to the time and the context in which the polls are conducted. And Luke, as usual, has sort of brilliantly laid out for us that many of the polls were right in terms of the gist of those polls. I would differ just a little bit in making the point that it was the size of the margin that was projected with respect to Biden, the idea that he had a comfortable lead in a number of states as suggested by a number of polls, and I'd have to go through each one. And again, I very much defer to Luke on this whole discussion. So I will add this, there is a tradition of oversampling Latinos, oversampling Blacks in these polls because they typically are less included in polls in order to make them nationally representative. I would suggest that serious consideration should be given to the extent to which rural voters are adequately represented, and particularly in those polls that rely upon online responses as a way of gauging what is public opinion in those areas, because we all know that access to internet services is lesser in rural areas than elsewhere. And then finally, quickly, something that I think Bob said earlier, forgive me, Bob, if I'm attributing this to you, you didn't say it, is that we have to think about what pollsters refer to as interviewer effect, right? The fact that some pollsters in telephone polls and in-person polls are not going to be comfortable saying that they will vote for Trump if they know that the results or the context and sort of political atmosphere is such that you are a, you know, basket of deplorables if you support Trump.
And well, along these lines about polling, what about the House and the Senate? Because the suggestion there, I mean, I think everybody thought that the Democrats were going to do much better, certainly in the Senate. And I don't think anybody was predicting that they would lose seats in the House. So they got, they were, it, I mean, is that still within the margin of error, Luke?
No, so yeah, I think in some ways we might be missing the lead story in regards to polling. And that's the 24th and the 22nd district are two nationally competitive, nationally watched districts. And the polling we had there, which comes from the Siena Research Institute, which is a reputable polling organization and typically does a pretty good job, was wrong. It had CATCo on the ropes in 24, and that doesn't seem to be the case. And it had one poll on NY22 where Brindisi was up 9. So I think to your question, Dave, this reflects a larger challenge with polling for congressional races and how there's a limited amount of the resources and entities that do this. And I think as a political scientist who watches particularly House elections, I would love to have more evidence to evaluate and try to understand the state of a given race. And we just don't have it because it costs money and it takes time, and who's going to invest in that? But certainly the story here is regionally, the polls were really wrong. And again, I'm not trying to be too critical of Siena. They do good work, but I'm interested in hearing more from their director, who's pretty upfront about these things, about, well, what happened? And that's worth watching.
Just a quick additional note to that. Yes, the Siena poll in both 22 and 24 were off. In 22, I had a meeting or was a part of a Zoom meeting with Brindisi's pollster, the Greenberg folks. I don't know what the name of that firm is, but it's a very reputable, old, outstanding polling firm. And their polls were just on spot on in agreement with the Siena polls. So they also had Brindisi up by 8 or 9 points. Yeah, so it does seem to me that if you have two good polling firms saying this, and then it really, really doesn't happen. Now, I think it will tighten. That guy said, things come back to the norm at election. So it's 8 or 9 points now, 3 weeks out, but it'll move toward the Republicans somewhat, he predicted, in the election. And we still don't know the results, obviously. But given all that, I'm interested in why there was such a discrepancy, yes.
Let's move on to the Electoral College. We do have a question about a plan to institute a proportional electoral system. And Christy, I know that that's something that's near and dear to you. How is that proceeding? What does it take to make it happen? And is there any chance realistically that it will?
Well, what the plan that is has the most impetus, I mentioned Maine and Nebraska, and those are the only two states who assign their electoral votes based, they give two electoral votes to the person who wins their the popular vote, and then allocate the rest depending on whether their congressional districts are vote for Democrats or Republicans, and we're not talking about many votes, and no other states that I know of have expressed interest in this. The thing that has some traction is called the National Popular Vote Compact. And what this is, and it's perfectly legitimate, the alternative is a constitutional amendment. I won't even go there because I think that one is not very feasible right now. But the National Popular Vote Compact, a number of states, I think 15 or 16 states, mostly Democratic states, have passed laws, New York has, that say we will allocate our electoral votes to the winner of the popular vote. So right now, the states which have, and that doesn't go, won't really go into effect until the states that have bought into that and promised to do that have together 270 electoral votes. Right now, the states that are in that list have 197, I believe, or 96 electoral votes. So to the extent that it's Democrats right now who seem to be worried and disadvantaged, perhaps, in the fact that we've had two Democratic winners of the popular vote who lost the election recently, the only way to get this is, I suppose, to convince Republican states, but more realistically, to get more states leaning Democratic and going along with that idea.
Well, there are at least two issues, though, about the National Popular Vote Compact. As you suggest, it's not designed to go into effect until a majority of, until enough states that constitute 270 electoral votes or more sign off on it. But the thing is, how do you enforce that among the states that sign the compact?
Yeah.
Suppose a state approves it, and then the following year says, no, we're not going to do that. We just changed our mind.
Right.
And changing legislature, you know, party control.
Yep.
I mean, I like the idea simply because I believe that the popular vote nationwide should ultimately matter beyond the quirky nature of the Electoral College, which, by the way, I mean, the Electoral College was not some brilliantly conceived, artfully constructed system. It was a slapdash, last minute, back of the envelope, bunch of guys in Philadelphia, sick and tired of being there. It's hot in Philadelphia in the summer, especially in 1787, and they wanted to go home. And they finally just sort of threw up their hands and said, well, let's just do this. And so it was, you know, put together with clarinet reeds and scotch tape, okay? And it's in the Constitution 220 years later. So yeah. It's in dire need of reform. The problem is, as Christy points out, amending the Constitution is basically, virtually an impossibility for, especially for something like
this. We almost got to it though. There was an amendment proposed in 1969 by Emanuel Siller, and it had bipartisan support. President Nixon said he would endorse it. It passed out of the House, it passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, but it got held up by basically Southern segregationists and rural senators and never saw the light of day. But that was very, and the, you know, it was a very popular move at that point, that amendment, interestingly.
Yeah, if I could just, and thank you, Bob, for that analysis of the Constitutional Convention, sort of saying we're going to go home and eat dinner. I would add that there was another theme running throughout the convention, and it had to do with whether to rest sovereignty within the states, which is what many of the representatives there wanted, not the nationalists, as opposed to resting sovereignty within the with the demos, and within the people. So it was a contest between state sovereignty versus popular sovereignty, and the Electoral College was a sort of compromise between those two, and embedded in that is the idea of preserving federalism and all of the, you know, positives that are supposed to go with federalism. I would argue, however, that the way that the Electoral College has evolved over time and the way that it operates is contrary to what its original intent was, rather than preserving state sovereignty across the board, or for that matter, federalism. What we're seeing before our very eyes that there's only four or five states that seem to matter in these elections. And so the rights of other states, the interests of other states, and so state sovereignty broadly writ has been thoroughly eroded by the way in which our politics have evolved so that it's just a handful of states that matter.
So
yes.
What's the impact on the system long term if only four or five states matter in the vote, and if a minority of voters have so much power in the Senate and, you know, as well as the presidency? And the Senate, of course, means the court. I know that I hate to say former colleague Tim Burns would speak quite passionately about minority rule, essentially. So what's the long-term impact here? Any one of you, Bob, you look like you're about to say something.
Well, we sort of know the impact, right? It gives disproportionate power to sparsely populated states and regions in relation to the country as a whole. California has about, 36 million people. The state of North Dakota has like six people in the whole state. They have, North Dakota has around 600,000 people. They have three electoral votes. Each electoral vote from North Dakota is worth far more than each electoral vote from California, or for that matter, New York. So it is a skewed system, and it's become more skewed as urban areas have grown. And it is fundamentally undemocratic. I mean, it is built on federalism, and it still has its defenders in that regard. But sure, it skews our politics. There's just no doubt about it.
Okay, we had a question about political advertising. And here in Central New York, of course, we have been inundated. I mean, I live almost exactly on the line between the 22nd and the 24th, and nothing but commercials, constantly, Tenney, Brindisi, Balter, Katko. And even when I watch the SU games, of course, in the ACC network, then I get I was getting the South Carolina and the North Carolina commercials too, as I'm sure all of you were. Were those ads, I mean, they were all tied to Trump, from both parties, basically. And they seem to work. So is this negative advertising effective? Luke?
Yes, that's why people spend millions of dollars to do it. that's the short answer. I think advertising certainly plays a role in shaping people's perceptions. It's hard to escape, not only on regular network television, which I don't have, but on social media and streaming devices. You know, it's all about having as targeted advertisements as possible. And again, in two nationally competitive races, the vast majority of the money comes out of the district, comes out of state, and is designed to try to influence the outcomes of these elections to tip it towards the respective parties of the people who are getting the money that want to win.
And here in Central New York, that translated into tremendous support for Donald Trump.
Well, I don't know if we can say that directly. There's a lot of variables in terms of why Katko and Tenney look like they're going to prevail. Advertising is part of that. I wouldn't put too much emphasis on it. I mean, grassroots politics matters as well. You look at Claudia Tenney's success, for instance. I mean, it comes at expanding her margins in the rural counties. It comes, it appears at this point, in cutting Brindisi's lead in Broome County by a half or a third, which few people expected. So advertising is a piece of that, but I think as important, if not more so, are concentrated efforts by the campaign at the grassroots level to consolidate their party base and turn out voters. So I don't think we want to ignore that either.
Could I just mention that negative, it's important to remember that negative advertising, political advertising, is as old as politics. I mean, Pericles was subject to relentless criticisms, this is ancient Greece, friends, that were to a great degree unjustified and sullied his reputation, which he deeply resented. I will just add, so there's nothing new about that. No politician was more vilified than Abraham Lincoln. And you can go to the Cornell Library and view the historical documents that Andrew D. White collected from the 1800s. It's a fascinating stuff to to see. I've looked at a little of it. One thing on Broome County, though, I had heard from an insider in the Brindisi campaign that they didn't get the normal recruitment and mobilization on the Binghamton University campus, right in the middle of Broome County, that they had in the last election just because of the pandemic and disruptions in higher education and everything else. And that may, I mean, not by itself, but that may have cost them significantly, several thousand votes, at least you can imagine, in Broome County, that is the Brindisi.
Okay, just a note, Christy has sent into the chat for everyone some suggested reading on the Electoral College, so take a look there. Question about the legal landscape now. Christy mentioned up front, 300 election claims have been made.
Yeah.
And so I mean, will he be able to tie this all up for a long time?
Potentially, yes, and I'm not an expert on this at all. I mean, it depends, obviously, what kind of claim it is and how, what court, what state it's in, what the type of the claim is. But a number of these attempts to either hold up things and or disqualify ballots have been struck down, most notably the one in Texas where his campaign was saying that I think 20,000 or maybe more, I don't know, many thousands of ballots that had been deposited in a convenient drop-off place, drive-through place, were okay to count. I guess I would be a little hopeful that it won't drag out for months and months, because I think election officials in most states are not unreasonably protective of their process. They know they're doing this right. They know they're doing it carefully. And I'm also a little bit optimistic for what I mentioned very early on this morning about other Republicans sort of downplaying Trump's claim that all of the, you know, absentee voting and post-election counting is invalid. So I'm hopeful that it won't take too long, or that we'll know enough, even if it's still going along, to be able to call things and have some decisions. But maybe I'm just being too, maybe I just want this over with.
Yeah, well, I think the extent to which it drags out, to Dave's question, will be partly a function of two things. One, what is the size of the margin of victory right. that indicated so far? And so even in the case of Wisconsin, former Republican Governor Scott Walker has said that it is virtually impossible to expect that a recount, should that be forced by a court, will somehow recoup the 20,000 votes that had. And so I think that will be a factor. First, the size of the lead that Biden has. Secondly, the extent to which local Republican officials right. will sort of reinforce the integrity of their state and local processes. And I think the third is, as I've said on the show before, what exactly is the legal claim that's being put forth by the yeah. challenge of the Trump administration? And do those claims simply rest on his allegation that something is wrong, or is it specifically geared toward arguing that state election laws have been contravened? If he's successful in making a case that state election laws and not a constitutional 14th or 5th Amendment due process or equal protection clause is at issue, but if he can successfully show the Supreme Court state election laws have been contravened, then he'll prevail, but I just don't see that happening. And then if I just add one other quick point, I don't see this Supreme Court, headed by Chief Justice John Roberts, who has been very keen on protecting the image, the sort of stature of a court that bears his name. I don't see him wading into the waters to support a president who has been as bombastic as this president has.
I'll just add to the great points that Nina and Christy made. I think it also matters not only the margin in the states in question, but the overall Electoral College margin. So if Trump were to win Pennsylvania, which I don't think is going to happen, and win North Carolina and Georgia, and that leaves Biden sitting at 270, and any one of these states could tip the balance, I think that's one story. But if Biden wins Pennsylvania and he's up to 290 and maybe takes either North Carolina or Georgia, then you need three or four states to go in a different direction. And that's when I particularly think you're going to see Republicans say, all right, forget this. It's not good for us to continue to go down this road. And in terms of Wisconsin, you mentioned a court requiring a recount. That would be interesting. They do have a system. If there's a small threshold, there's an automatic recount. And then there's another window where a campaign can request and pay for a recount. And that's where it's at right now. And so when the Trump campaign says that he wants a recount in Wisconsin, he could pay for one. It'll be interesting to see if that actually happens.
Well, he has some number of billions. We don't know how many.
We're going to go, if it's okay, just a few more minutes. We've gone past nine, but we started a little late. So we want to give everybody a full hour's worth, get your money's worth. We have a question about federalizing the elections. Is there any, is there a way that something like that has been done in some other countries, they're federalizing their national elections? Could we do something like that here?
What do you mean federal? What does that mean?
Well, I'm interpreting for the questioner, but I think what we're trying to do is instead of, this is really the electoral a version of the Electoral College question.
Well, or is it that we would have a single, I mean, in the Netherlands, which, to take one good example, and that's a much smaller country, but so you are, they have a national list of voters, or for everybody who's a citizen, immediately when you turn 18, you're registered. And for example, once you're registered, which everybody is, you can vote on election day anywhere in the country. So if you're on vacation, you can vote because it's all in this one national registration system. Other countries may not quite get there, but they're running. They don't have the level of federalism we have. That is, I would bet anything, never going to happen. I mean, we prize our federalism, and it's got, we could talk forever about its good points and its bad points and its advantages and disadvantages. But one of the embedded in the Constitution is the federalism governing elections, that states have control over that. And, you know, we see this all the time, and it is inefficient. There are all kinds of things that if you were starting to design a country from scratch right now, you might not do that. But I don't think that's going to change here.
Yeah, that may not change. But I do think, and again, I'm sort of speaking theoretically as well, I think there's a case to be made for establishing a constitutionally based national right to vote, because, you know, for a country that, you know, brags about being the example of democracy, we are not guaranteed the right to vote. Instead, that right rests with states. And the only place where the Constitution comes in is in terms of prescribing the bases upon which states can deny the right to vote. It can't deny it on the basis of race, on the basis of gender, under the basis of age, and so forth. And so there's an argument to be made for that, because shameful, and other countries are watching us in this moment, shameful for us is that in some states there are ballots that are missing. In other states, if the ballots were dutifully sent in by the voter but not delivered by the post office, well, those not get counted. Yeah. It'll be to a court to decide whether that's the case. And then in some states, voters are having to wait in line 6-12 hours. And to me, that goes against the idea of equal voting rights.
You know, absolutely. And, you know, looking at Georgia and the closure of polling places in Black neighborhoods, and this vote suppression, there's no question. But the federal government has gotten into this through the Help Americans Vote Act, HAVA, which basically prohibits, well, no, I'll look at it in a positive way. It says that everybody, including people with disabilities, have a right to vote, and that states need to make accommodations or set up systems that allows that to happen. It seems to me that I'm not an expert on this at all, but I think the reasoning that allowed that law to be passed could allow something like you're talking about, a general law that says, that even may have specifics in it about how long people should be required, or, you know, allowed to wait, or how many polling places per population or whatever. But yeah, I think that that could happen given the precedent of the Help America Vote Act. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think that that could happen, and that actually did happen in the late 1960s when Congress passed a law that lowered the voting age to 18, but then the Supreme
Court. That was a constitutional amendment, not a law.
Well, no, initially Congress passed a law that lowered the voting age to 18, and then the Supreme Court struck that down, and that necessitated
the
26th Amendment that then lowered the voting age. And so my point here is that, sure, Congress can pass a law, but then that can be challenged under the 19th Amendment, which guarantees to states the right to a Republican government, and in the history showing that a law isn't enough to confer a right across the board to vote. It's going to take a constitutional amendment.
Yeah. So we got two constitutional amendments now, Electoral College and the right to vote, right?
Easy, right?
Unfortunately, we are out of time, so I just want to thank our panelists. So please join me in thanking our panelists from Ivory Tower. Thank you.
Thank you. This was fun.